at SOCKS illustrates how menial and hilarious the complaints can become. SEALs go through some extreme punishment, both physical and mental, in training and in combat. Many people therefore believe, wrongly, that this sense of perspective gives us the superhuman ability to never sweat the small stuff. This could not be more wrong. Wet socks are like our kryptonite. They're like a nightmare wrapped around your feet, soggy, squishy, incapable of drying, sapping your feet of their energy as they cause your skin to prune. Wet socks were created by the devil to punish men for their sins, crafted by the wicked as an antidote to order and all things good. We emphatically and unambiguously hate wet socks. And it's not just wet socks. SEALs hate a lot of things that involve cold and wet circumstances, probably because we were born in them, molded by them, forged by them. BUDS is basically a six-month experience of cold, wet, soggy pain infused with extreme physical exertion. That about sums it up. So as a result, we don't like being wet. And we feel perfectly entitled to complain about it when we do get wet. The difference, well, one of the differences, between a SEAL platoon and a Special Forces team is this. When we come upon a river, let's say knee-high water depth, and we have another 15 kilometers to go, the Special Forces guys will just walk across it. Not SEALs. Not if we don't absolutely have to. We will walk another kilometer to find a better crossing. We will build a bridge if we have to. Anything to keep the feet dry. Okay, so the wet socks thing is a bit maniacal, born mostly out of our somewhat traumatic experiences on the beaches of beautiful Coronado, California, where the BUDS Training Center is located. And truthfully, I am half joking about the wet socks, but only half. Any SEAL listening to this is nodding in agreement. I am illustrating a point. We sweat the small stuff so that the big problems don't bother us as much. We let in a little weakness, blow off a little steam, so that we are well rested for life's true challenges. Because on the other side of that river might be 100 bad guys armed with PKMs and AK-47s and surrounded by buried pressure plate IEDs that we can't see or detect. That's the big stuff. Fundamentally, this is an exercise in control. We can control wet socks. We can't control what is on the other side of that river. As I noted previously of the Stoic philosophy, it is useful to focus on what you can control and accept what you cannot. Sweating the small stuff is, in essence, about regaining control over the smaller problems we face. When I said that I complained, almost irrationally, about the little problems I faced while hospitalized, bad food, uncomfortable clothing, the inability of those around me to say exactly the right thing, and less so about the big problems, like permanent blindness, I was focusing on what I could control. I accepted what I could not. Perhaps it wasn't that irrational after all. How you complain is important. What you complain about is important. Again, think about who you want to be. Negativity is unpopular, and so are negative people. Dan is generally pretty pessimistic is not how I would want to be described by my peers. It isn't who I want to be. A good rule of thumb is this. If you aren't making someone laugh with your complaints, then you might be doing it wrong. Lighthearted humor wrapped up in your menial grumbling should be the goal. During my hospitalization, I certainly could have made improvements in how I complained, even if I may have justified the act itself. We allow ourselves to sweat the small stuff because we strive to be detail-oriented. Details matter. Paying attention to detail is an absolute must for performing successfully in life, whether in the life-and-death situations of combat or doing payroll for your business. Small mistakes pile up and make everything harder in the long run. This accomplishes a few things, and I'm speaking mostly to how the average American interacts with politics here. For one, you won't be so outraged. Anytime you are paying attention to the detail and nuance of a controversy or topic, you will be decidedly less extreme about it. Using your deductive reasoning to dive into a topic will moderate your emotions on the subject. You will also be happier. Outrage is antipathetic to happiness, after all. You will blow off steam in a healthy way so that when bigger problems arise, you are more emotionally capable of dealing with them. And most important, you will be a better citizen. You will be more understanding of your political opponent and their ideas. You will also be better equipped to debate those ideas and more likely to find a reasonable compromise agreeable to both sides. Be self-aware. Be happy. Make people laugh, not just for your sake, but for the sake of everyone around you. Chapter 6: The Right Sense of Shame. In America today, we too often look at personal failings as things to overcome, move past, or forget. Sometimes we should do one or all of those things. But we should also do something else: learn our lesson. The list of public figures who run headlong into self-inflicted failure, personal, political, or otherwise, and then reemerge shameless without having appeared to learn a thing is long. Don't get me wrong, I'm no opponent of redemption, far from it. I certainly believe there should be space for reemergence from public scorn. I believe redemption is a trademark of an enlightened society. One of the more detestable social trends now is the mocking of redemption and the dismissing of the idea that it is possible or even desirable. In place of a system of repentance, justice, and mercy, we have a culture of mindless fury, an outrage culture. Outrage culture has contorted our ability to seek redemption and recover from failure, which in turn has contorted our sense of shame. Not only do we feel no shame for being outraged, but that same outrage incentivizes a lack of shame for just about anything. Lies, dubious news reporting, scandals, even simple cases of clumsy commentary. Redemption is harder and harder to come by. Take my experience with Saturday Night Live. It would have been easy to call for Pete Davidson to be fired after his infamous joke about my appearance in November of 2018, only a few days before my election. I remember finding out about the previous night's skit. I woke up Sunday morning unaware of what had happened. I started my day as I usually do, checking the calendar on my phone. My first election to public office was days away, and my Sunday was packed. After church, we would meet up with volunteers doing door-to-door canvassing for the campaign, and then head to Huffman, Texas, for a campaign event at the local bar, which meant I would need to change into jeans and boots after church. This was my routine. Then I checked my text messages. Dude, SNL, you made it! Those expletives, expletives, expletives at SNL. Hitman in a porno? That was the general nature of the reactions. Keep in mind, my friends in the SEAL teams are cut from a certain cloth. The lengths to which we go to make fun of each other are often extreme, and as a result, we grow pretty thick skin. That being said, we keep it in the family. My friends will often say, "I get to make fun of your injury," but they sure as hell don't. Oh, lucky me, I guess. So I looked up the clip on my phone as I made coffee. My Apple News feed already had a couple stories about it. Wow, I remember thinking, how bad could it be? I started the video. The skit in question was from SNL's longest recurring sketch, Weekend Update. The sketch is a faux news segment where comedians poke fun at the biggest stories of the week. The hosts, dating back to 1975, have been a veritable who's who of comedy. Chevy Chase, Dennis Miller, Jimmy Fallon, Tina Fey, Seth Meyers, to name a few. The skit typically runs after the musical guest plays their first set. That week, the producers had comedian Pete Davidson jump on Weekend Update as a special guest. Davidson's segment poked fun at some of the politicians running that year. It's fair game. There's no shortage of characters in the United States Congress. Sometimes we make ourselves easy targets. Pete flashed through photos of candidates and had a joke or two for each. He's a gifted comedian with a sharp wit and an amusing, contagious habit of laughing at the camera when he delivers his jokes. Davidson knocked through a few senior politicians. Senator Rick Scott of Florida, a Republican, and New York Congressman Pete King, a Republican, before he came to me. Also Republican, in case you didn't know. "This guy is kind of cool," Davidson cracked. "Dan Crenshaw." As the producers flashed my photo to go along with the commentary, Weekend Update host Michael Che sensed the danger and gave an, "Oh, come on, man," as a warning shot to Davidson. I carry my worst war wound on my face, and the only way to mask it is with a patch or prosthetic. It's visible and impossible to hide, not that I want to. And that night, it was the target of Davidson's crack. "You might be surprised to hear that he's a congressional candidate from Texas," and not a hitman in a porno. As the audience howled, Davidson jumped in with a quick aside. I'm sorry, I know he lost his eye in war or whatever. The first thing I noticed about Pete Davidson's monologue was that he referred to the list of candidates running for office as gross people. So it was pretty clear that this was not going to be a favorable analysis of my venture into the public sphere. Not surprising, really. It is SNL, after all, and the whole point is to make fun of people. But here's the thing. Calling someone gross isn't really funny, at least not in the way it was portrayed in the skit. It was just a statement of fact, and it set a clear tone for the real objective of the skit, discrediting the character of those they were about to roast. It was the first shot across the bow of this cultural micro-battle. Definitely not enough to offend me, but it certainly set the tone for the true intention of the joke. Then I got to the part of the skit that I have to admit was pretty funny. The hitman in a porno line made me chuckle a little bit. Maybe because it brought to mind so many questions about precisely how that particular film would play out. For the sake of this narrative, those are questions best left unanswered. Suffice to say, this part of Davidson's joke was not what offended people. The line that riled everyone up was, I know he lost his eye in war, or whatever. It felt like an ad-lib, perhaps prompted by Michael Che's warning to Davidson seconds beforehand. It was dismissive, and clearly an indication that the reason behind my gross look didn't really matter. What really mattered was my political affiliation, and therefore, all bets were off. All decency eschewed. Because this was really about winning a battle in the culture war. I don't think I am rushing to judgment on this point either. Why am I so sure this was meant to be a dig at conservatives in particular? Well, it's simple, because right after Pete got done roasting me, he went on to take jabs at the one Democrat on the list of gross people. And before leading into a pretty mild joke set, he said, "Here's a Democrat so I look fair." Right, enough said. One of the reasons I didn't demand an apology was that everyone deserves some space to seek redemption and forgiveness. Now, it was pretty clear that the intention of Pete Davidson and SNL was to berate and demean Republicans running for office, at least in this particular skit. SNL pokes fun at Democrats plenty, but the bias in this skit, right before an election, seemed obvious. But I wasn't sure that his motivations went any deeper. I doubted he was out to belittle and mock my war injuries. It sure sounded like that. But maybe, just maybe, that wasn't the intention. Maybe, just maybe, I didn't have to act offended, and I wasn't, and demand that he atone for his transgressions. Redemption prevailed, and I had the opportunity to forgive Pete on next week's episode of SNL. More on that shortly. But 9 months later, the SNL showrunners had another cast member come under fire. Shane Gillis, a young comedian, had just realized his dream of joining America's greatest and longest-running sketch comedy show. After he was hired, reporters and bloggers pored over his past routines and found instances of him using a racial slur against Chinese people and a slur against gay people on a podcast. The slurs are not good, and I am not defending them. But we should also ask, was the intent of his comments based in prejudice? Aren't comedians supposed to push boundaries and make mistakes in the process? And while his comments would be utterly unacceptable in regular conversation, it was clear that Gillis was using them in a form of shock comedy rather than a reflection of deep-rooted biases against those communities. Intent matters. SNL could have granted Gillis the same redemptive opportunity they gave Pete Davidson. A chance to apologize in a way that was funny and unifying, and that acknowledged the deep-felt pain those slurs might cause others. He could have been allowed to explain that he meant no offense and was just doing as comedians do. They could have explained that context matters, mistakes can be made, and sometimes they go too far. They didn't. They caved to the outrage mob and fired Gillis before he could shoot his first episode. This is how shame is used as a weapon in the modern era. Gillis isn't a one-off event, either. Kevin Hart had to step down from hosting the Oscars for similar reasons. Even outspoken progressive Sarah Silverman was fired from a movie after unacceptable past comedic content came to light. That we even have journalists whose job it is to act as inquisitors, combing through a comedian's past, of all things, in search of wrongthink or blasphemy, is absurd. but it demonstrates how hungry mass media is to find a public figure to humiliate and thus toss to the wolves of an outrage mob. These were once tactics reserved for politicians aspiring to run our government, which is understandable given their role as representatives. Now, it infects every element of our culture. This need to shame and see people shamed. Pete Davidson survived. Shane Gillis didn't. But most important, it shows how shame has been overused and mishandled. Public shame once had a purpose. It was a politician resigning for carrying on an extramarital affair and thus not acting worthy of his office. It was a CEO caught using slurs in a literal way that reflected true bias against a race, gender, or creed. A sense of shame is what regulated bad behavior and purged it from office. But today, shame has lost its meaning and its direction. Every day it's a new outrage, especially on social media. Every day the mob roots out someone who tweeted an off-color remark or misspoke on the news and cries justice as they seek their ruin. The notion of shame is losing meaning, and if it were a stock, it'd be plummeting. The mob is crying wolf, not revealing legitimate wrongdoing. We have simultaneously deprived it of its value and meaning while still wielding it as a club with which to swiftly ruin careers and reputations. This loss of meaning has warped the incentives public figures face when engaging in a sense of shame. In short, they have stopped feeling shame altogether. What does this new world look like, where traditional remorse and redemption are things of the past? It looks like former South Carolina governor and congressman Mark Sanford, who disappeared for 4 days while serving as governor. Confronted by the press after his story of hiking the Appalachian Trail fell apart, Sanford admitted he had been in Argentina, pursuing an extramarital affair with a mistress. He should have resigned from office. He didn't, and instead successfully ran for Congress in 2012. It looks a lot like former Congresswoman Katie Hill, who resigned from the House of Representatives in 2019 after being caught in an unethical personal relationship with a member of her staff. Her resignation statement gave no admission of wrongdoing, even though a relationship with a staffer is a serious ethics violation. Not only that, but she was given a hero's welcome at a rally soon after her fall from grace, proof yet again that our culture has elevated the wrong heroes and the wrong attributes to aspire to. It looks a lot like United States Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, who served in the military stateside for much of the 1970s, but later claimed to have served in Vietnam. When the misleading implication of service was exposed, he apologized for having failed to be clear or precise, rather than taking personal responsibility for his actions. It looks a lot like Andrew Rosenthal of the New York Times. In 1992, he fabricated an incident in which then-President George H.W. Bush was, quote-unquote, amazed at seeing a supermarket scanner. Rosenthal wasn't even present for the incident. The truth was that the president was perfectly familiar with ordinary grocery stores. But the deliberate falsehood soon became a popular byword for an out-of-touch narrative against the president. For his efforts, Rosenthal eventually rose to become editorial page editor of The Times. It looks a lot like the governor of Virginia, Ralph Northam. His page on his 1984 medical school yearbook contains a picture of two men, one wearing blackface makeup and the other wearing a KKK mask. If that picture was ever considered humorous, it shouldn't have been, and it certainly isn't now. Questions were rightfully raised, but Governor Northam didn't apologize. After acknowledging his place in the photo, he changed his story and actually denied that the photo was him at all. And gave no plausible explanation for why it was on his yearbook page in the first place. He refused to resign, and his only attempt at redemption was to spend the coming months pushing for the most progressive agenda possible, earning him praise and forgiveness from left-wing journalists. A December 2019 Washington Post op-ed titled "How Ralph Northam Came Back from the Political Dead" outlined in glowing terms the reasons why his shameless lack of explanation should be forgiven and forgotten. It is impossible to imagine the Post giving the same generous treatment to a Republican governor, and impossible to ignore the fact that Northam never even admitted wrongdoing. Shouldn't forgiveness be a two-way street? Shouldn't there be some admission of guilt prior to redemption? It looks a lot like G. Gordon Liddy, who committed real crimes, burglary, conspiracy, illegal wiretapping, in the course of his service to President Richard Nixon, yet remains unrepentant for them. His career since, especially as a media figure, has flourished. It looks a lot like the entire cabal of left-leaning mainstream journalists and news anchors who wrongfully indicted the Covington Catholic kids in the court of public opinion after their relatively uneventful confrontation with a Native American activist. Because Nick Sandman, one of the students, wore a Make America Great Again red hat as he silently faced the activist, news anchors were quick to describe the group of kids as an angry racist mob. Even when more videos of the incident came out and it was made clear that the kids acted rather appropriately in the face of chaos, the media never backed down. Nick Sandman sued the various news agencies for hundreds of millions of dollars after their refusal to admit wrongdoing. If you're well-connected, or you can claim that you're a victim, or you can hide behind a facade of noble journalism, failure doesn't touch you. Americans know all this instinctively, even if they don't know the details. They know that failure, for them, has real consequences. They know that failure to pay their debts means they lose their house. They know that criminal acts mean they go to jail. They know that public notoriety stemming from an ill-thought-out social media post means it will be impossible to find a job. They know failure is real. They know that failure is not real to the wealthy and powerful, not like it is to them. What should a story of failure look like? Failure and its companion, redemption, should look like a young United States Navy ensign assigned to a destroyer in the Philippines in 1907. One day, entering a familiar harbor, he decides to get by with an estimate of his ship's position instead of taking proper bearings. He runs it aground, and the ship must be pulled free of the mud bank into which its keel has settled. It is a grave error and tremendous offense for a naval officer. He reports his error. The young officer is rightly court-martialed and found guilty. Our naval officer's career future is uncertain, and he is denied the opportunity to serve on the Navy's crown jewels, the battleships. Instead, he is shunted over to a relatively new and unglamorous branch of the naval service, the submarines. But he doesn't quit in the face of adversity. The young officer becomes an expert on their use and theory, and the experience places him in good stead when, as arguably the greatest admiral in American history, Chester Nimitz leads America to victory in the Pacific. That is how to handle failure. Nimitz exhibited a willingness to internalize rather than externalize. He assumed responsibility. He learned. He changed. He grew. Outrage culture doesn't have room for a Nimitz, and that's the problem. A little shame is good. It keeps you accountable and on course. It is a necessary element of personal responsibility, which is a necessary bedrock for a successful life. Shame leads to humility, the good kind, which leads to thoughtfulness, a desire to improve, and ultimately, mental fortitude. Outrage culture has had an unfortunate effect on our society's sense of shame. We rarely get it right these days. One of the reasons my moment on Saturday Night Live was so unique and so surprising was because it was just the right amount of shame. The public interactions between myself and SNL during the 7 days between Pete Davidson's famous insult and my appearance were characterized by temperance instead of outrage. After it happened, I was careful not to demand an apology, careful not to call for the online mob to scream, "Shame!" I was careful not to play the part of the aggrieved victim. When crafting a response, the words that stuck with me came from a brief presentation I heard during student orientation at the Harvard Kennedy School, where I did my master's program after retiring from the military. A wise professor advised us, "While you're here, try hard not to offend, and try harder not to be offended." It was both simple and profound, and it always stuck with me. It certainly wasn't a lesson I needed, but I was well aware of the hypersensitivity on college campuses that had formed in recent years, and this professor was addressing that issue in a pretty thoughtful way. He was implying that we should consider the intentions of someone's words before defaulting to feeling offended. And so that was my statement. This allowed the producers at SNL the space to react in a way that exhibited the right amount of shame. They wanted to apologize, but they wanted to do it their way. They wanted to do it the right way. By the next weekend, producer Lorne Michaels had convinced me to fly to New York and make an appearance on the show. I said no at first. I had other events planned, it being Veterans Day weekend and all. "Couldn't we do it another weekend?" I asked. "No," he replied, "precisely because it was Veterans Day weekend, and we had the opportunity to give America's veterans a heartfelt message. I could say whatever I wanted," he told me. So I agreed. The experience was surreal. We got to work as soon as we arrived in New York on Friday evening, going over the initial drafts of the jokes. My wife and I made some edits and offered some additional ideas, such as suggesting Pete looked eerily similar to a troll doll. We got our own dressing room, right next to Robert De Niro's. The hallways were small and the set crowded, which I guess isn't that surprising considering the location in Manhattan where space is hard to come by. I got to meet Kate McKinnon, who is just as funny and cool as you would expect. My wife, Tara, a longtime fan of Kenan Thompson and all that, was able to show her gratitude to Kenan for publicly showing support for me after the initial skit with Davidson, when he stated that such a joke was never somewhere I would go. I found out that Pete wasn't a terrible guy, just a comedian who had made a mistake. He apologized privately and asked if I wanted some pot. I laughed and said no. The hallways were already plenty smoke-filled from Lil Wayne and his crew. The next night, we rehearsed the skit in front of a live audience. SNL does this to test the jokes and make last-minute changes before the show goes live. The entire staff of writers and producers gather in Lauren's office to trade notes and rework the scripts. It is an intense and purposeful process, and frankly, a lot of fun to be a part of. As the scripts get changed, the staff gets to work rewriting the cue cards, which are all done by hand and shuffled through manually during the skits. There are no teleprompters. It is truly an old-school sketch comedy environment. My time on stage came about halfway through the show. The stagehands prepared me to be rolled into the scene on a roller chair from offstage. There was no turning back now. Better not screw this up, I thought. The crowd cheered and we started the skit. After Pete's apology, he offered to let me get him back a little bit. And so I did. In keeping with the tradition of poking fun at appearances, I let loose a series of jokes that likened Pete to a troll doll with a tapeworm and Martin Short's character from the Santa Claus 3. At one point, my phone started ringing, and it just so happened that the ringtone was a song by Ariana Grande, Pete's ex-girlfriend. The audience particularly liked that one. We wrapped up the skit with my monologue about Veterans Day and my Never Forget message to America. We succeeded in turning an offensive jab at wounded veterans into a heartfelt message to the same. Americans seemed to feel pretty good about it. Now, imagine a different scenario. Imagine I had done what is normally done in these situations, demanded that my allies focus the entirety of their rage on SNL, shame them into submission, and not give them even the slightest benefit of the doubt. This scenario easily could have happened. I was new to this outrage game. I might have quickly tweeted out something snarky and hard-hitting, given I hadn't quite realized the gravity of the situation when it first happened. Truth is, I initially struggled with the right message. I didn't feel offended, but I also had to take into account that I wasn't just responding for myself. I was responding on behalf of many veterans who felt SNL had gone too far, diminishing their sacrifices for the country. I couldn't just dismiss that. I needed to acknowledge that righteous feeling of anger felt by many while also avoiding fanning the flames unnecessarily. This, of course, goes against the very nature of our current politics. The laws of modern politics dictate that you never throw water on the flames of a good controversy if you can use it to your advantage. You're supposed to play the part of the aggrieved victim to the greatest extent possible and use that moral superiority to club your opponents into submission. If I had done that, SNL would have been put in an awkward position and become more entrenched. It's highly unlikely that they would have reached out and invited me on the show. It's far more likely that they would have done one of two things: refuse to apologize and weather the storm, or apologize profusely to appease the mob. Neither would have been inspiring nor satisfying. The battle would have continued to rage either way. The second scenario is the one that normally plays out. The troubling part about my SNL story was that it was actually surprising. America breathed a collective sigh of relief because I didn't freak out. And Americans smiled when Pete and I joked about it a week later. The reaction was so positive precisely because it was so unexpected. And this fact should trouble us. Shouldn't we pause and ask, should it really be all that surprising? Isn't it indicative of a decaying culture that we can no longer just expect people to assume the best of intentions of one another? That we can no longer expect some degree of forgiveness, or at least an uninterested shrug when someone offends us? Unfortunately, the outrage mob's usual reaction is to demand an extreme level of shame from their target. The degree of impropriety doesn't appear to change the intensity of the demands either. The mob's goal is to beat its opponent into total submission until they are literally begging for forgiveness, or destroy their reputation should they refuse to apologize. I could have easily unleashed that outrage mob, and it would have been fully in keeping with the expectations of most Americans. This normalization of outrage has consequences. The result is an equally extreme and unhealthy reaction to the outrage mob. Imagine the reactions to the outrage mob as a bell curve, with the most nuanced responses in the middle, like, I'm sorry you took my comments that way, but here is how I meant it. The most subservient responses on the right side of the bell curve. I apologize deeply for my insensitive comments, for instance. And the most unapologetic responses on the left side of the bell curve, like, I'm not resigning. I want to make a note here. The left and right distinction is not meant to indicate any political affiliation. It's just a bell curve. I want you to imagine two different bell curves. The first one looks like an upside-down smiley face. So that means there's a lot of nuanced reactions taking place, and a high likelihood of those reactions. Now imagine that bell curve totally inverted. So the bell curve looks more like a smiley face, which means there's a lot of likelihood of an unapologetic reaction or a high likelihood of a subservient reaction. The nuanced reactions are the least likely to occur. So, which one seems more accurate in today's society? If you said the second bell curve, then I agree. The truth is that proportional responses to the outrage mob seem fewer and further between, whereas the extreme responses are increasingly the only option. The extreme nature of the outrage mob, willing to pounce at even the slightest offense, devoid of any benefit of the doubt, has forced the shame response into extreme categories. Everyone has two options now: show deep shame or show no shame. The middle option of showing a little amount of shame in proportion to the actual offense is hardly an option at all. There is simply no reward for it. No grace is given. No outrage will subside. I grew up as a fan of Saved by the Bell. Don't judge me. So I'm going to use Mario Lopez as an example. In the summer of 2019, during an interview, Mario was quoted as saying that he did not believe a 3-year-old was old enough to choose their own gender. He said he believed it was the parent's job to explain to the child that its biological gender is, in fact, its gender. It was a pretty common sense, uncontroversial stance to take. And if you disagree, then I am very happy you are actually reading my book. But the social justice warriors pounced quickly. He was shamed intensely and consistently on social media. The end result was a subservient apology that left no room for nuance, only a complete admission of wrongdoing. He called his own comments ignorant and insensitive, adding that he now had a deeper understanding of how hurtful they were. The self-assured man that Lopez played in Saved by the Bell had been beaten into submission by the outrage mob. These are extreme reactions. I think Mario Lopez knew full well that he had nothing to apologize for, at least not as profusely as he did. He did so because of public pressure, because of the outrage mob. Most people in this category have better things to do than fight through the Twitter storm that condemned them. Attempts to engage in discussion or nuance would be lost on their audience, and they know it. So they choose the most subservient mea culpa response they can, exhibit an extreme level of shame for their actions, and hope that it will be enough to move the mob on to the next victim. Tim Keller's quote comes to mind. Fear-based repentance makes us hate ourselves. Joy-based repentance makes us hate the sin. This has two unfortunate effects. It empowers the outrage mob, and it normalizes improper shame responses. We should ask ourselves, do we really want to live in a culture where reactive apologies are the norm, even when clearly not required? When we think back to our heroes, do we look up to someone who engages in strong discourse and pushes back against unjust accusation? Or do we value someone who gives in to unjust accusations immediately just to get the accusers off their back? Again, I am not judging the victims of the outrage mob I mentioned above. Like I said, they have their own priorities and lives to live. But I worry greatly, and we all should, about the trend taking place and the notion that extreme shame should be normalized. I argue that we must fight back. But there is a right way to correct course, and there is a wrong way. The other side of the bell curve is the other extreme, the no shame extreme. The other side of that inverted bell curve is Queen Cersei, whom you may recall from HBO's Game of Thrones. Walking naked down the streets of King's Landing, she smirks at the angry peasants as she is forced on the Walk of Atonement. She is being shamed, but she feels no such emotion herself. The contempt they feel for her is immediately transferred back at them. She walks naked and embarrassed, but is ultimately shameless. There is no introspection, no calls for greater understanding, no well-meaning dialogue between her and the mob, just mutual contempt. She will never apologize to the angry mob because there is no reward for doing so. Their anger will not subside. This is the other extreme of our culture's reaction to the outrage mob, and it is just as unhealthy. It is especially true in politics, where politicians descended upon by the outrage mob no longer have an incentive to give in at all. This is true even when the accusations leveled against said politicians are actually legitimate. The governor of Virginia has never taken any kind of responsibility for an obviously racist costume from his past. Hillary Clinton has never admitted that putting highly classified information on a personal server deserved any kind of punishment, as any of us in the military would have swiftly faced for the same violation. Congressman Steve King never really apologized for racist comments, but instead tried to rationalize them. I want to be clear that I am not giving any of these politicians an excuse for their lack of shame. There really isn't any excuse. I am saying that this lack of shame didn't just appear out of nowhere. It is a conditioned response that originates from previous experiences where the outrage mob never forgives and never forgets. There is no space given for benefit of the doubt, and therefore no space for any apology whatsoever. That is the large-scale cultural problem with shame, in a nutshell. So, how do we fix this? What is the right amount of shame? First of all, we must begin with inverting the curve back to normal. We have to normalize proportional shame responses again. We have to engage in nuance again. We have to be bold enough to defend ourselves and humble enough to admit some wrongdoing. And just as important, we as a culture must reward that proportional response instead of punishing it. In short, we have to be more like Ellen DeGeneres and reward people like her. In October 2019, she was confronted with the Twitter outrage mob when she dared to appear at a Cowboys game with her friend, former President George W. Bush. The outrage was pronounced enough that she felt the need to address it on a later show. Did she apologize? No. Did she dismiss her attackers as mere outraged fools to be ignored? No. She simply explained herself. And in doing so, she made a beautiful contribution to the eventual death of outrage culture. She started off by noting the Twitter outrage that had occurred, summed up by, "Why is a gay Hollywood liberal sitting next to a conservative Republican president?" She then went on to explain her side. "The fact is that I am friends with a lot of people who don't share the same beliefs that I have. We are all different, and I think we've forgotten that that's okay that we are all different. But just because I don't agree with someone on everything doesn't mean that I am not going to be friends with them. When I say be kind to one another, I don't mean only the people that think the same way you do. I mean be kind to everyone." Boom. Outrage mob completely deflated. The controversy surrounding J.K. Rowling, author of the Harry Potter series, was also emblematic of the right response to the outrage mob. After learning that Maya Forstater was fired from a think tank for criticizing the notion that biological men can become women and that private citizens should not be forced to acknowledge another's desired identity, Rowling jumped to her defense. Bear in mind, Rowling is no social conservative, far from it. But she also believes that no one should be punished for stating their beliefs, especially when that belief is rooted in basic biological truth. On Twitter, Rowling stated, "Dress however you please. Call yourself whatever you like. Sleep with any consenting adult who'll have you. Live your best life in peace and security. But force women out of their jobs for stating that sex is real? Hashtag I stand with Maya. Hashtag this is not a drill." It was obvious from Rowling's tweet that she has no problem with the transgender community. Again, she is no social traditionalist. But she understands a fundamental truth about the nature of rights that the British employment judge who ruled against Forstater does not. The judge ruled that Forstater's comments were not worthy of respect in a democratic society. But in fact, a truly democratic society is one that protects its citizens' rights to be who they want, while also not forcing others to believe the same. Much like the right to free speech, the freedom to be a transgender person is a protected negative right, meaning that no one has the right to stop you from doing so. But to make it a positive right, meaning others now have a legal obligation to participate in your beliefs, is utterly unthinkable. That is what J.K. Rowling was saying in her tweet, and she was raked over the hot digital coals of social media for it. According to the outrage mob, disagreement about the nature of sex was an unpalatable offense. Rowling did not back down. Good for her. This is all deeply related to our end goal, fortitude. It is related because our individual sense of shame and the way we engage in it contributes to the toxic cultural transition to the extremes that we have seen. For us to fix the bigger problems, we have to fix ourselves first. We have to be mentally tough enough to both disengage from outrage and also develop a proper individual sense of shame in our daily lives. Feeling shame is actually good. It is synonymous with feeling accountable for our actions and consciously admitting that our actions might not have been the right ones. And I am not necessarily talking about the deep moral regret narrative of a Dostoevsky novel, where the murderer Raskolnikov agonizes over his crimes in an excruciating manner. I am talking about starting with the smallest of life's missteps and the substandard ways in which we live our daily lives. In other words, sweating the small stuff. We should feel a sense of shame for not training hard enough, for sleeping in too late, for eating that extra scoop of ice cream. We should feel regret after walking past a piece of trash next to a storm drain, knowing full well it is going straight into the ocean. We should feel bad for not tipping that hardworking waiter. We should be embarrassed when we owe a friend money and they have to constantly remind us to pay them back. We should feel lazy for leaving our food tray on the table in a fast food restaurant, even though trash cans are right there. We should feel ashamed after honking at the car in front of us when the light turns green, even though its driver may very well have been a single mom checking on her kid, momentarily distracted. We should feel shame for insulting the character and intent of someone on Twitter just because they disagree with us, knowing full well we would never have the guts to speak to them that way in person. We should feel discredited when we become emotionally attached to political positions and pretend not to hear facts or context that debunks what we previously thought. I use these examples because we have all done it. We are all guilty on at least one account, probably more. And the truth is that all of us will probably continue to make these mistakes and continue being the imperfect human beings that we are. But my goal is not to make us perfect. I certainly am not. It is to make us more aware. My goal is to encourage a healthy sense of shame so that, at the very least, we are aspiring to a higher ideal, a higher sense of self. Having no sense of shame for all of those transgressions I listed above is a de facto justification for bad behavior and boorishness. And justifying inadequate behavior isn't very different from promoting it, practically speaking. You might say, "I didn't work out today because I was tired, and dang it, I have a good excuse for being tired." Sure, maybe, maybe not. Only you know the answer to that. But if you truly feel no shame for skipping leg day at the gym, what on earth will motivate you to go the next day, and the day after that? If you really feel no shame for leaving your trash behind, hey, it's a city street, it's already dirty, and we have street cleaners. Well then, who's to say you won't keep doing it and contribute to the littered mess that you surely disapprove of? Feeling shame for the small stuff takes practice, and it takes mental dedication. It requires one to let go of their ego and admit imperfection. It may be unrealistic to demand that everyone act perfectly virtuous at all times, but it should be less idealistic to hope that we are at least aware of our imperfections and seek to mend them. In short, be accountable for everything you do. It was why Commander Jocko Willink, one of my mentors in the teams, wrote an entire book about the subject called Extreme Ownership. The premise of the book is quite simple. Everything is your fault. Be accountable. Take ownership. Take responsibility. From this responsibility, you will find freedom. Feeling accountable is the only thing that is going to make you better. Hell, it is the only thing that keeps you alive. When we debrief operations in the SEAL teams, whether in training or in real-world combat, we are relentless with criticism. There is no coddling, only truth. The mistakes must be well known to everyone because that is the only way to ensure that everyone actually learns from them. There isn't time to make that mistake a second time because it could very well be fatal. On one debrief after a mission in Iraq, our chief gathered us around. He was exactly the spitting image of a SEAL chief you might imagine. Quiet, professional, ruthlessly aggressive, careful and direct with his words, and built like an NFL running back. He didn't like to lift heavy weights because his stature was already too damn muscular. He was naturally stronger than everyone in the platoon. When he spoke, we listened. Like the SEAL chief played by Dennis Haysbert in the movie Navy SEALs, he was a well-respected leader. Being an officer and the acting platoon commander, I was technically his boss, but I always listened when he had something to say. "Gents," he began, "you're all fucked up." We weren't sure exactly why at first. Nothing major had gone wrong on this op. We were on time, and we hit the right target. We'd left Camp Ramadi at 0200 hours and driven straight into one of the worst neighborhoods in Iraq. We weren't perfectly clandestine. We were driving giant armored vehicles, after all. But we were still good enough to wake the bad guys up from their beds. They never saw us coming. No one got hurt. We coordinated well with our Iraqi partners, and they took custody of the Al-Qaeda operative we had captured. Our intel team had been tracking this guy for months, and when we confirmed his location, it was game on. But it wasn't perfect, and Chief was going to tell us why. He pointed to our guys in charge of getting the vehicles ready. "The seating assignments were screwed up. We looked like idiots trying to figure out who was supposed to be in which vehicle before leaving the base. Unfuck yourselves." "Roger," that's the only acceptable response. "And you guys," he said, pointing to our comms team, "why the hell didn't we have SATCOM when we were on target? I thought you said you fixed the antenna. Didn't you test that?" "We did, but the angle..." "Shut up. Fix it." "Yep, will do." "And sir," he said, looking at me. But it wasn't a real sir. It was a, "I have to call you sir because that's good military bearing and I am a professional, but we both know I have a decade of experience that you don't." He was right. "Tell your boys at NIIA, which stood for the National Iraqi Intelligence Agency, with whom I was the primary liaison, that they better start bringing actual guns on these ops and not that dumbass sniper rifle that guy carries around." He was referring to the NIIA commander who always carried this Russian Dragunov rifle with a non-working scope into close quarters. It was definitely not the optimal weapon, and it should have been my job to say something about it. We ignored it because he was always out in the back of the assault anyway. Roger that, Chief. We will fix it. No one can quite make you feel as small as a SEAL chief can. But here's the thing. He can't make you feel shame. No one can. A sense of shame only really comes from within. I think we know this intuitively. And in the SEAL teams, it is deeply embedded in our culture. As a SEAL, you simply cannot fathom committing less than 110% effort at all times. Every SEAL does his duty, even the smallest job, simply for the sake of the duty itself. The mantra, "If you are going to do it, you might as well be the best at it," is repeated constantly. We live by it. And this high expectation works only if it comes from within. It is impossible for leaders to make you feel something and then enforce it. A teacher or boss or parent can certainly correct our behavior or misdeeds. And we may nod in agreement about our transgression. But only we can actually feel bad for having done it. You either internalize it or you don't. I would argue that the more immune you are to a healthy sense of shame, the more susceptible you are to contributing to big cultural problems. The outrage mob, and the extreme response of shamelessness. Outrage mobs are born of many things, but one of them is the total unwillingness to learn and discover. Remember the advice I gave to high school students earlier in this book? Wait before becoming emotionally attached to an opinion. There's nothing wrong with saying, "I don't know." Ignorance on its own is not cause to feel ashamed. There are plenty of things that I am not an expert on, and never will be. But ignorance coupled with strong opinions is a reason to feel ashamed. And it is one of the hardest things to get people to actually feel ashamed about. This shameless ignorance is difficult to reverse once it takes hold. And I believe it is a primary cause of outrage-based call-out culture. As a politician, I am always in the center of a debate, either publicly or privately with constituents. I'm often disagreeing with someone on the left or the right. I've noticed that both sides of the political spectrum hate nothing more than for you to tell them that you disagree with their long-held beliefs. The reaction is swift, severe, and highly emotional. Take, for example, the slogans, "No more endless wars," and "Bring the troops home," repeated excitedly by both conservatives and liberals. I have spent a good deal of time explaining via social media and op-eds in the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post, why these slogans are hollow, wrong-headed, and severely lacking in the nuance necessary to understand our nation's overseas involvements. The reaction on social media, upon learning of my contrarian viewpoint, takes on the form of the emotional reasoning that I discussed previously. I am called a warmonger, a rhino, a neocon, responded to with everything except a reasonable policy debate. People hate being told they are wrong, and seem to hate it even more when it comes from someone they thought was on their side. It is easy to understand why. I think we can all admit that once we have publicly defended an argument, it is a huge blow to our ego when we are presented with facts and arguments that clearly debunk it. It is damn near impossible to admit we were wrong, especially to some slimy politician who, quote-unquote, sold out as soon as he got to Washington, D.C., I am still trying to figure out what the hell that even means. Even though my beliefs are firmly conservative, I run into this sentiment often, and it comes from both the left and the right. People do not trust politicians, even when those elected officials work to be truthful and grounded in fact. This mistrust is a growing feature, not a bug, in our democratic system. That distrust is perhaps justified, and maybe even emblematic of healthy skepticism. The problem is that most people are never skeptical of their own beliefs. Haidt and Lukianoff discuss this as one of the great untruths in the coddling of the American mind, in which they strongly condemn the notion that we should always trust our feelings. Dr. Haidt uses a metaphor to explain why. He writes about the human mind as a rider on an elephant, where the rider is our conscious mind, steering the unconscious mind represented by the elephant. The elephant is obviously larger and can easily overpower the rider, which is indicative of the emotional power of the unconscious mind. The role of the rider is to question that emotional reasoning and use conscious reasoning to investigate what is actually true and based on facts and reality. Dr. Haidt writes, Emotional reasoning is the cognitive distortion that occurs whenever the writer interprets what is happening in ways that are consistent with the elephant's reactive emotional state, without investigating what is true. This applies to a variety of psychological issues, whether they be depression, victimhood, trauma, or anxiety. Cognitive behavioral therapy can be used to correct this unhealthy thinking by encouraging the patient to consciously question those preconceived notions. If we are to engage in truth-seeking and avoid outrage, we must aggressively challenge the beliefs and opinions that led us to that outrage in the first place. We have to start assuming that maybe, just maybe, there might be more to the story than our emotional elephant is telling us. We must train the unconscious elephant to feel some shame for emotional reasoning. If we don't, the shameless outrage becomes normalized and the behavior continues to worsen. The rationalization that the writer engages in begins to rewire our brains. At first, there was a small voice screaming, "You screwed up! Own it!" But eventually, after losing the battle so many times to a writer rationalizing your misstep, that voice stops talking. The elephant has been fully trained in the worst of ways, and the result is outrage behavior. The result is shamelessness. Your elephant is your unconscious mess of feelings and automatic behaviors. The rider of that elephant can question the elephant's instincts and drive it toward better behavior. But only the elephant can actually feel the shame that is necessary to hold you accountable. That feeling of shame should be encouraged, not rationalized away. One thing I hear a lot is, "Well, that's just what I believe, and it's my opinion, so you can't really argue with that." Well, I can, actually. An opinion is valuable only insofar as it can be backed up by some element of reason and facts. The common story being told by many people, especially in the outrage mob Twitter sphere, is that their opinion is true simply because it is their truth. There is no sense of shame whatsoever in their inability to explain why they hold that opinion. I have watched in dismay as this happens from both the left and right. When challenged, they default to talking points that don't even address the question and attack a straw man argument, an imagined argument that is easily defeated, but ultimately not the argument even being made by their opponent. For instance, when debating the merits of building additional walls along the length of the border, left-wing activists often accuse Republicans of racism and xenophobia instead of addressing the actual question, shouldn't we secure our southern border? Once past that, they attack a straw man argument, claiming Republicans want an expensive 2,000-mile concrete wall. The actual proposal during the budget standoff in early 2019 was regarding 234 miles of steel bollard fencing, where Border Patrol needed reinforcement, not a 2,000-mile Great Wall of the southern border, as was often claimed by media and my colleagues in the Democrat Party. Or take the 9/11 truthers, the conspiracy movement that believes the September 11th attacks were perpetuated not by Al-Qaeda, but by the Bush administration. On every anniversary of 9/11, their pronouncements get thousands of likes on social media. It is rather concerning. Popular Mechanics did a great public service by painstakingly going through each silly tenet of trutherism. A bomb took down Building 5. Fire doesn't melt steel beams, and so on. When confronted with certain scientific realities, such as fire may not melt steel beams, but it sure as hell can weaken them to the point where they can no longer bear their load, truthers have a choice. They can admit that they have been suckered, or they can double down. A common truther refrain is to ignore Popular Mechanics' findings and instead accuse their writers and editors of being paid handsome sums by the government to help cover up the conspiracy. Though truthers are a tiny conspiratorial fringe, they represent a wider trend of Americans growing so embroiled in their own political beliefs that they will beclown themselves rather than simply admit that a fair point was made and move on. This phenomenon has bewildered me. I get told how wrong I am all the time, literally every day on social media and elsewhere. And it's fine. It's obviously part of the job. Sometimes it is simple disagreement on a policy approach, but sometimes it is disagreement on the basic facts. Sometimes I have been proven wrong and forced to reckon with it. During a Twitter-based policy dispute early in my term with Representative Joe Kennedy of Massachusetts, I made the mistake of misrepresenting a bill in one of my tweets. I screwed up, and Kennedy corrected me, publicly. It sucked. But it didn't make me angry. It made me better. I reached out to him privately afterward to hash it out, and we have since developed a friendship that I value greatly. Honest debate makes us better at thinking more deeply about why we believe what we believe. If you find yourself calling someone a communist, traitor, or rhino because they disagree with you, it is a good indication that your arguments are shallow and your emotions are driving your thinking. And shouldn't we feel a little shame about that? Dropping weapons-grade accusations like that of racism, Nazism, sexism, homophobia, without cause or evidence, is a sign of weakness, not strength. It is reflective of a mind that refuses to engage itself critically, and instead reaches for insult and ad hominem attacks to shroud ignorance and policy illiteracy. I encountered this firsthand at a campus event at Arizona State University in the spring of 2019. During the question and answer session with students, a young man took to the microphone to tell me I was a Nazi and that I should be ashamed for my service in Afghanistan, not proud. There was no intellectual argument made, no debate to be had on the merits of America's involvement in Afghanistan, just ad hominem attacks fueled by too much time on the internet following equally angry activists. What are the chances his little outburst actually earned him respect or changed any minds? Certainly not mine. Again, I'm okay with ignorance about complex subjects. Ignorance is fine. I have no problem with it. We all can't be experts on everything, even if Wikipedia makes us feel that way. But ignorance incorporated with overly strong opinions? Yes, that's a problem. One of the greatest aspects of religion is that it imbues